Hello, everyone. Welcome to another episode of the Open UK's Summer of Open Source Security series. I'm Matt Yakovitz, the host of the series, and I'm here with the Open UK's CEO, Amanda Brock. Amanda, how are you doing today?
I'm pretty good, Matt, and all the better for talking to you.
Ah, yes. It is a wonderful day out. It's a little rainy here, but it isn't so bad. So I'm glad to be here chatting to you about security today. But before we get there, for those who are just tuning in and maybe have not heard of the Open UK, can you give us maybe a little bit of background on the Open UK itself and tell us a little bit about you?
Sure. So Open UK is an industry organization, and we are about the business of open technology. And open technology for us is open source software, open hardware, and open data. And by being about the business of open technology, rather than simply representing UK companies in that space, what we do is we bring together people. And although it sounds possibly like we're less people focused, actually we're more people focused, and we bring together everybody in the space working in open source software, hardware, and data. So we do all sorts of different things under three pillars: community, legal and policy, and learning. Bringing together that sort of leadership community, using the influence to improve laws and policies in the UK around open, and then teaching the next generation the things that they need to know to become the leaders of the future. And me, I'm probably not the person you'd expect to have on a security podcast, to be quite honest. I'm a bit of an imposter here today. And I'm here because I have a background where I was a lawyer. I was a lawyer for 25 years. I've worked in and around open source for about 15. And there are lots of things going on in our summer of security conversation that expand away from pure engineering and DevSecOps and security. And I'm going to talk to you a bit today, Matt, about some of those.
Yeah, well, and so don't diminish yourself on your role in the security side of things, because we all have a very important role in the security side of things nowadays. No one is left unimpacted and is not a potential, you know, area where we can secure, you know, our system. That being said,
I agree, Matt. I think we all have something to contribute on security.
Yeah. So how did Open UK look at security and say, this is an area we want to get involved in, that we need to get involved in? How did that come about?
So I've been running Open UK for about 2.5 years. And I think within the first year of my role as CEO, it became quite clear that security was going to be very high up the agenda. And if you think about it, 15 years ago, I was working with salespeople trying to get companies to adopt open source. It's a very different world today. We've got that adoption, and we've got that adoption across our public sector as well as our private sector. But of course, the thing that stops that expanding or having certain usages, if you strategically think that through, is security. And it became apparent to me quickly that that was going to be the biggest blocker for open source going forwards, for open source software, the fact that people misunderstand security. When I say misunderstand, they often think security is an open source problem, whereas it's actually a software issue, it's a software challenge in a digitalized world. And the more we've digitalized, the more we need to accept that we're software defined, and if we're software defined, that we deal with security. So we'd sort of talked about that quite early stage. A few of our directors and participants, ambassadors and things, are quite well known in security. And we focused, I think, back in something like March 2020. Am I getting that right? I get my years confused with lockdown. But we joined OpenSSF, and we were very early stage, so early stage that we were in one of the initial releases of members of OpenSSF and one of the press releases, because it was still newsworthy that they were getting any members. And we also, through our legal group, Chris Easton and Robert Carolina. Chris runs the legal group, and Robert is a deep expert in security and open source from a US and UK legal perspective. The two of them led a response to the Biden ordinance, which I'm pretty certain was May 2021. So we knew that on that international playing field, we had to engage. And we could see leadership coming out of the US government in that ordinance, and coming out of the White House in that ordinance, that we wanted to participate in. So I suspect we were the only non-US organization to respond. And a lot of our response was going back to that. Remember that it's not an open source issue. Supply chain isn't just about open source. It's also a software general. It's also a general software issue. So we got engaged quite early stage, and we brought together our own security advisory board within Open UK. And we've been doing some work, doing some training sessions for various civil service departments and engaging in things like our Summer of Open Source Security.
I think it's important to give a little context there, because the last few years, we have seen an incredible number of breaches and hacks and security issues that have reached the levels of the highest government, right? Yeah. So what we're talking about is things like the SolarWinds debacle a few years ago. Then we've got, yes, Heartbleed. We've also got the Log4j example.
Exactly.
And basically what has happened was, as open source software or even like some of the tools in the open source space have become more ubiquitous in the industry, people are using them in ways that maybe leave more data exposed than they have in the past. And so that means that any exploits that are out there tend to be bigger and more severe. And that has a cascading impact. And when... Go ahead.
No, it almost amuses me that one of the biggest problems is where open source is tucked away quietly and sometimes secretly in proprietary code that we see these problems.
Well, and that's a big issue, right? So yeah, that was no more evident than with the Log4j, right? Mm-hmm. So when you look at that, all of a sudden you saw all these proprietary systems that were impacted by this open source software. And I think you get that also with whether it's OpenSSL or any sort of libraries that are embedded across multiple applications, you see that. Mm. But that these incidents really brought the attention to this issue that, oh, wait a minute, we don't know what's in our software. We don't know what layers exist, but also we don't necessarily know who is developing and maintaining these in a lot of cases.
Yeah.
I think that there's a funny meme that I remember seeing. It's, or maybe it was a cartoon where it's, all of this software is maintained by one person in this little tiny town. And so you've got thousands or millions of applications that rely on one person just having some time in his coffee break.
Yeah. So that second question for me is almost more difficult. The first one, you're asking me about the ordinance. You're asking me what this is all about. And we saw real leadership from the White House because these security issues had been happening. The White House has David Corden, who is a big open source guy historically, sitting there as the CTO. And there's a bunch of other people around him, I'm told, who I don't know, but who also have got deep open source experience. And when we saw that leadership come out of the Biden administration, what we saw was a document where the people behind it clearly knew what they were talking about. And often when you see legislation that's aimed around open source, the people don't know what they're talking about. The language doesn't work. It doesn't sit well. So it was really quite an attractive thing when we saw it to us to be able to engage with. But also you have this piece where open source adoption, open source contribution is really diverse and global. And we saw the US taking leadership and not a lot of response from the rest of the world. So we really wanted to engage with it because the solution could never be US-centric, not unless you're going to draw your US drawbridges up and stop us coming in and out, which I don't see happening. You've got this global collaboration. You've got this global utilization, global digitalization. So there was some great leadership coming out of the US. And the leadership focused, as you say, on supply chain and software bill of materials, or SBOMs, as we generally call them. And it required that these be put in place. I think it was by the 31st of July, 2022, for all suppliers to the US. Now, I'm going to get this wrong, whether it was federal or I think it's federal systems. Anybody supplying federal government in the US had to put an SBOM in place. And I think that's been extended. I mean, it doesn't really impact me so much, but I think that's been pushed back. But I know that Kate Stewart, who runs SPDX for Linux Foundation, which is a software bill of materials tool, Kate shared a survey with us over the summer where I think it's about 75% of US companies now use SBOMs. We did the same kind of question in our survey in the UK in June, and a couple of people have told me they were surprised by the outcome because they thought it was high. and it was 21%. And what we're looking at here is we're looking at how do you identify what software is being shared? Now, that's something that those of us who've worked in distros and things have had to do for commercial customers for years, right? We've had to try and pull together a certificate of originality, some sort of document, and it would often be doing multiple different formats to suit different customers. So in many ways, that creating a universal standard is a great thing. But people do want to know what they're running. They want to know what licenses are in there, what they've got to comply with. So it makes lots of sense. And also they want to work out the dependencies and where the vulnerabilities are and what they can change and how they can do it and, you know, what swaps in and out, that kind of stuff. So I think that makes sense. The second piece you asked me about, I get more uncomfortable with, and that's knowing who contributed the code. And I guess that the lens I always look at open source through is the one I was taught first. And that was back in 2008 with a bunch of people at Canonical and Ubuntu, who many of whom had come from Debian and who were real free software guys. It evolved into open source people. And having to be identified, Open UK probably gathers less data than it should because I'm so part of that old school. Why do we need that? We don't touch it. We don't need to identify people. So there is this whole concept and discussion going on in the UK of beneficial ownership and looking at where the code has come from. And that's going to be a difficult conversation with communities and businesses, I think.
Yeah, no, it definitely will be. I think that we know why this is important, like you, many of us, but why do you think this work around, whether it's the SBOM or security in general, why is this becoming even more critical now as we start to embed more and more software? Maybe just tell us in your own words.
You know, it's why I wanted to do this discussion with you, as well as all of the different engineers who are deep experts having these conversations with you. And we started by saying there's room for everybody in this space, but there's a requirement for everybody in this space too. And I think we all need to build an understanding. I talk about this a lot, that the journey of the last 10 years of open source and how we see the world digitalize. I use the term software defined. I don't know if engineers will like that, but it's kind of software defined. Everything we do as we move digital becomes dependent on software, whether it's the creation of products and services, the distribution, or the consumption. So every business is digitalized and is using software, and the engineers' roles have just elevated. Now, if you think about that big picture, what you're looking at is the engineers being able to make choices that they never got to before and having more power in organizations, alongside a time where the creation of Git and the public repos and GitHub and GitLab and whatever, allowing people much simpler access. So they don't have to go through legal departments. They don't have to go through procurement and finance. They just take the code into their organization. What we've seen is across the whole of the public and private sector, particularly here in the UK, because we've had an open first strategy for a decade in the public sector from UK government. So what we see is that this open source stuff has permeated our day-to-day services. It has permeated our infrastructure and business and our infrastructure in the public sector. So our national infrastructure, our roads and bridges, our national critical infrastructure has this open source sitting underneath it. But I'm not sure that the way that it's been implemented in the last decade always understands what needs done to make it well-maintained and secure in the long term. And I think there's an educational piece, and I think that educational piece needs to happen now. And I mean now, sort of today and the next 18 months to 3 years, or we risk seeing a backpedal away from open source because it's just too difficult to fix. And I don't want to see that happen. So I want us to have this honest conversation and look at how we help those who are using open source understand how to curate it better, and look at how the public sector stewards its open source and manages that curation.
Well, and this is a dangerous space as open source becomes more prevalent in our infrastructure, because it leads to questions. And there are real concerns, and then there's the FUD concerns, right?
So totally.
those fear, uncertainty, doubts that come up. In fact, I shared with you last week an article where the FBI was quoted as saying, open source code repositories allow unfettered access to all individuals, to include those with nefarious intentions. Like a warning of, oh, because it's open source, all of those bad actors, whether they're, you know, terrorists in another country or extremists within our own borders, they have access and they could find ways to exploit that access. What do you say to that kind of FUD? Because that's been around for a while.
Exactly. And that's exactly why I think if something is FUD, the best way to deal with it is head on. So avoiding it, not having the conversation, you know, stand up and call it out. And I think the first call out is that in a digitalized world, we're absolutely dependent on software. Software has an issue with security, all software, and we need to manage that. And you then get into the debate about whether it's more manageable when it's all behind closed doors and nobody knows what's going on, or whether having our open world where everybody can see the code, yes, there are some risks attached to that. At the same time, we have a global and collective response to any problems. And we never really know how much is being swept under the carpet behind closed doors. You know, I've been in situations where I've seen companies not want to disclose problems because they know it's going to affect their share prices. And that's the kind of risk you have when this is all dealt with behind closed doors. So what I want to be part of is a conversation where we help government to understand, we help the public sector, we help enterprise to understand that managing this collaboratively is the best way forward for all of us. And that by being open, it's not going to be more of a security risk than by being closed code. But I think we need to take a step back now. And we need to think about this curation word that I keep using, because it's not the developers who create open source. It's not their responsibility. They give you something for free. They've put this into the world. It's the user's responsibility.
So, Amanda, you mentioned curation. And so isn't curation similar to what we've already been doing with the distributions in the past, where, you know, you look at whether it's Red Hat or Ubuntu or other distributions, they're taking packages at a certain level and embedding them, and then they're selling support and a guarantee that what you're getting is supportable and it's something that is going to be kept up to date. Are we just talking about doing that again in just a different form?
So, Matt, the answer I'm going to give you is a real lawyer's answer. So yes and no. So when we talk about curation, I think it's a bigger picture. And I think you take the open source communities, whether those are individuals, companies, collaborations between the two, and you look at them on the one side of the road. Say they're on the left-hand side of the road or the freeway or the highway, and on the right-hand side, what you've got on this side of the motorway are the users. And you need to get across those. And you're right, there are companies like Red Hat with RHEL where they have an enterprise edition that is like going across a zebra crossing to get you across that road in a safe way. And when you get to the other side of the zebra crossing, you are a user who has the things in place that you need to have to know that you've got well-curated code. Not everybody wants to do it that way. And not everybody wants to use the same thing. And that's one of the beauties of open and open source software, is that it gives you those freedoms and those decisions to take things and do them differently or have different bits. Or maybe you want to modify and add something to, you know, an existing open source package or create your own bits and pieces around it. Now, it won't always be that off the peg standard enterprise type product. And I think rather than look even at particular companies, talking about enterprise editions of products or supports contracts, those kind of things, those fit within curation. But I think there's other bits where companies and sectors want to learn to do their own thing. They want to build their own ecosystem. The Digitalization Task Force for the energy sector in the UK, I was an advisor to them, and that was one of the things that started to focus my mind on this space. They want to build a digital spine that's an open source spine for the energy sector. And I know other utilities would be interested in reusing that. So they're not going to go and take that standard enterprise product. And what they're going to have to do is either develop the skills over on the user side of the freeway, the motorway, and themselves manage the curation, or they're going to have to buy people in with services and with skills that allow them to do that. I think one of the things we'll see evolve in the next few months is really good definitions around curation. What does it mean? I also talk about stewardship, because I think the public sector will look at building its own bodies and that they'll be slightly different from anything we've seen to date. possibly public-private enterprises, but they'll build these bodies who do that curation and a whole bunch more. So it would be like an OSPO, but not like a foundation, but not, and a whole combination of things. So I think curation and stewardship are going to be big topics. And I don't think they'll just be specific to a sector in a country or to a country. I think this conversation needs to become a big stage one, and it's something that we hope to be quite engaged with at Open UK and to try and bring others who are interested together. We're planning a spring 2023 conference where we start to really look at this and invite other governments to join us in that conversation.
So when we talk about, like, you know, you mentioned it's not just about the packages like Aurel. So when you talk about curation, are you talking about like curation of repositories with actual code? So you can say this code is at a certain level, so that way if you did want to contribute or alter it, you have a baseline that you know is clean and secure? Okay.
Possibly, and part of it. And I think that curation that you talk about with RHEL or any other enterprise product could just be of itself curation if that's all you need and you go and you pay the professional provider. I interviewed a chap called Ed Alford at New Look for our last report, and Ed was talking about the decisions they've made and the sort of decisions they've made around risk and how they manage risk. So they use things, but they make sure that they have indemnity through a professional provider like Red Hat, and New Look's a UK fashion chain. So the way they've done it is to look at making sure the professional provider does their curation effectively. They don't try and do it themselves. Other organisations we talk to, like the BBC or Starling Bank or Skyscanner, you know, they use of a lot of open source, and they use all sorts of different things that they bring together in their own way. So for me, the curation is the technical good housekeeping, the technical governance, the technical hygiene, your policies, your procedures, your technical implementations and how you do that and the standards that you do that to. It's then your governance, your compliance. It's also going to be how you understand your supply chain, how you manage the dependencies, how you do that, go forward, ensuring that what you're using is maintained and secure. So it's quite a big picture. It's quite a disciplined picture. On the legal bit, I have edited a book, and whenever I mention the book, I always say I'm never doing it again, and I'm not. It was horrendous. But I have edited a book of 24 chapters on the legal side, and I don't think there's another text like it. It has 23 authors. That will be out at the end of October. It's open access. It's printed by Oxford University Press, but it's open access. So hopefully that will be a tool to help some of the legal people who are, you know, trying to get up to speed, say, on patents or copyright or whatever bit of the governance they need to know about. But there aren't so many people who are deep experts, and we're going to have to see a lot more of that expertise evolve across governance and legal people, across finance people. The broader skill set needs to evolve, not just for the engineers, to make sure that we're doing this curation right.
So this is an interesting topic because there is a lot of potential for good and bad with the curation process, right? So we talked about some of the good, but one of the concerns that I often come back to is the development of competing standards and making things less portable between organizations, industries, or even countries. Because if you have a curated standard for the UK and one for the US, and they don't necessarily do the same thing, that could potentially lead to more confusion and a worse experience. Absolutely. Because we've got more of a competing standard, more of technologies or different things to learn. The portability between those standards or the curations might not work.
True. And the curation doesn't have to be associated and tied to standards. And if we're going to talk about standards, I'm going to say that standards should be open. We shouldn't be developing more closed standards. I don't know why we're doing it. They should all be open. We should be evolving them in an open way. Nothing else makes sense. But there's the de facto standards. And it's like the difference between the sort of OpenStack people and Kubernetes people, right? But you might want to use both. We don't want to dictate. We want to leave people's options open. Curation shouldn't be narrowed down as it gets defined to something that means that we become rigid in what everybody can do. We want to keep it open. You want to keep it flexible. It should be more about the practices that are required rather than you use this because we say so. I mean, for me, it should never be that.
Yeah, I think that, yeah, it's a challenge. And there's a lot of work that needs to be done in this space in order to get it right. And so we're going to need to focus on how to do that in the future. So a lot of opportunities, though.
There's a huge, huge opportunity. And there's not just a huge opportunity to engage and be involved. For lots of people who have worked in open source for a long time or even a short time but have developed great skills, there is going to be a moment in time, I think, of 6 months to 5 years where your skills are going to be so needed and so in demand in terms of making sure that our open source is what it should be and just making sure that this is consistent and well managed and done well. That those in this space have a huge opportunity to make money if that's what they're about. You know, there's a financial opportunity there. But I think there's also, for anybody who really believes in open source and the values of open source, I think there's a risk. And the risk is that we have been adopted massively quickly in a way that most of us didn't expect over the last decade. That trajectory to being like 48 to 98% of code bases, that's happened quicker than anybody could have expected. And often when something happens fast, it's done without the disciplines that are needed for it to have longevity. So if you actually care about open source, I think now is the time to focus on that and to contribute so that we can ensure that it goes forward on that basis. Because if it is too easy to say, you know, this open source is just too much work, people will flip back to proprietary and it will flip back quickly.
Yeah. And I think that's one of the interesting things is the evolution of the open source space and really any space. You know, as you have a movement that moves quickly, it is very flexible and agile, but it lacks a lot of the standards or the governance or the
discipline
guide rails.
Yeah.
For it. And that means that it can move quickly, but then that does leave a fairly brittle foundation in some cases. And so as we reach the maturity stage in the open source space, this is an area we need to work on. And unfortunately for a lot of people, they like open source because it doesn't have necessarily the rules and the standards and no one can tell me what to do. And now we have to put some of these.
So I agree, but I think there's also that we should do things well, right? And my experience of engineers is that they want to do things well, and actually they're quite disciplined and quite structured in their approaches to things. Okay. So there's lots of rules that exist that they've sort of put in place without being asked to. But I think that the focus needs to be on the user end more than the contributor end, because I think there will be a bit on the contributor. You know, I'm not going to be disingenuous or mislead anybody, but I think the main focus for change needs to be on the users so that they learn how to do it right.
So what is the Open UK doing in the near term to work on this problem?
So we have an event on the 19th of September. Well, first of all, what we're doing, Matt, is the Summer of Open Source Software Security, doing both the podcasts that you've been doing and sessions with a number of international colleagues, primarily from the US, that are webinars that are available at openuk.uk/security/security. And we have also pulled together the sort of finale of that Summer of Open Source Software Security as an event on the 19th of September. Now, it's a relatively small face-to-face event in London with just over 100 people, about 30 of whom are speaking through the day. And we have some keynotes, we have panels, we've got Jim Zemlin, we've got Lord Maud, who created the UK's sort of strategy a decade ago. He was the Cabinet Office Minister at the time. We've got Salima Van from the UN and Eric Brewer from Google, all keynoting for us. And then we've got panels looking at what's infrastructure and open source. We're looking at SBOMs and supply chain. We're looking at OSPOs and governance. And then we're drilling down into security, into the technical challenges and the policy challenges. And then the final bit of it is the funding. So how are we going to, you know, bring the world together to join this up and stop it just being US-centric or stop it being Japan or UK-centric and make it a collaborative effort the way that open source people, you know, do everything by nature. And we have that, and then we have an event taking place early next year, which will be on a much bigger scale. which will take these same conversations and bring them to a much larger international audience in London of 1,000+. So that's where we can engage everybody who's listening today and bring them along with us.
Excellent. Well, Amanda, thank you for sharing your vision on the security side and what Open UK is doing. I think that people who are listening should definitely think how they can get involved and how they can make a difference in this topic.
Thanks very much, Matt.